Audible Frontiers presents Solaris, the Definitive Edition. Written by Stanisław Lem. Translated by Bill Johnston. Narrated by Alessandro Giuliani.
Chapter 1. Newcomer. At 1900 hours ship's time, I climbed down the metal ladder past the bays on either side into the capsule. Inside, there was just enough room to raise my elbows. After I attached the end of the cables into the port jutting from the side of the capsule, my spacesuit filled with air, and from that point on, I couldn't make the slightest movement. I stood, or rather hung suspended, in a bed of air, all of one piece with my metal shell. Raising my eyes through the convex porthole, I could see the walls of the bay and, higher up, leaning in, Moderate's face. It quickly disappeared, and everything went dark as the heavy protective cone was put in place from above. I heard the 8 times repeated whirr of the electric motors tightening the screws, then the hiss of air entering the shock absorbers. My eyes were getting used to the dark. I could already make out the pale green shape of the only gauge. "Ready, Kelvin?" I heard in my headset. "Ready, Moderate," I replied. "Don't worry about a thing. Station'll bring you in," he said. "Bon voyage." Before I could answer, there was a rasping sound overhead and the capsule shook. I tensed my muscles instinctively, but nothing else happened. "When do I take off?" I asked, hearing a rustling noise like fine grains of sand falling on a diaphragm.
"You're already in flight, Kelvin. Be well,"
came Moderate's voice in my ear. Before I believed it, a broad gap opened up in front of my face, through which I could see stars. I tried in vain to spot Alpha Aquarii, towards which the Prometheus was now headed. The sky in this part of the galaxy meant nothing to me. I didn't know a single constellation, and all I saw through the porthole was glittering dust. I waited for the stars to start smoking. I didn't get to see it. They merely began to fade and disappear, dissolving against a reddening background. I realized I was in the upper strata of the atmosphere. Stiff in my cocoon of pneumatic cushions, all I could do was look straight ahead. There was still no horizon. I flew on, not feeling any movement, but slowly and insidiously my body grew hotter and hotter. Outside, there arose a soft, penetrating twitter like the sound of metal against wet glass. If it weren't for the numbers flashing on the gauge, I wouldn't have been aware of the speed of my descent. The stars were gone. The porthole was filled with a ruddy-colored brightness. I could hear the heavy beat of my own pulse. My face burned. On my neck, I felt cold blowing from the air conditioning. I regretted not having managed to see the Prometheus. It must have been out of sight by the time the porthole automatically opened. The capsule shuddered once and twice, vibrated in a disagreeable way. The shaking passed through all the layers of insulation and cushions and entered deep into my body. The green face of the gauge grew hazy. I stared at it without being afraid. I hadn't come all this way only to perish at my destination. "Come in, Solaris Station," I said. "Solaris Station, Solaris Station, you need to do something. I think I'm destabilizing." "Solaris Station, this is Newcomer, over." And once again I'd missed the crucial moment when the planet came into view. It extended vast and flat. From the size of the streaks on its surface, I could tell I was still a long way off, or rather a long way up, since I'd already passed that intangible boundary where distance from a celestial body becomes altitude. I was descending. Still descending. I could feel it now, even when I closed my eyes. I opened them at once, because I wanted to see as much as possible. I waited out a minute or so of silence, then called again. I received no response this time, either. Crackling volleys of static repeated in my headphones, against the background of a hum so deep and low, seemed to be the voice of the planet itself. The orange sky in the spy hole covered over with a film. The glass darkened. I flinched involuntarily, insofar as the pneumatic swaths permitted it. Then, a moment later, I realized these were clouds. A whole host of them moved abruptly upwards as if blown. I was still flying, now in sunlight, now in shadow, because the capsule was turning on its vertical axis, and the huge, swollen-looking face of the sun was passing smoothly across my eyes, appearing on the left and setting on the right. All at once, through the crackle and the hum, a distant voice began talking right in my ear.
Solaris Station to Newcomer. Solaris Station to Newcomer. A-OK. Newcomer is under control of the station. Solaris Station to Newcomer. Prepare for docking at 0 hour. Attention. Commencing countdown. 250. 249. 248.
The individual words were separated by split-second mewing noises that showed it was not a human talking. That was strange, to say the least. Usually, every living soul would run to the docking bay when someone new was arriving, especially someone directly from Earth. I didn't have time to think about it, however, because the huge circle that the sun had been turning around me stood on end along with the plane towards which I was dropping. After this movement, there came another in the opposite direction. I was rocking like the bob of a huge pendulum, fighting back dizziness. Against the expanse of the planet rising vertically like a wall, striped with dirty lilac-colored and blackish streaks, I spotted a fine checkerboard of white and green dots that marked the location of the station. At the same time, something detached with a snap from the exterior of the capsule, the long necklace of an annular parachute which flapped abruptly. In this noise there was something unutterably terrestrial. After so many months, the first real sound of wind. Everything began to happen very quickly. Up till now, I'd only known that I was falling. Now, I could see it. The white and green checkerboard was getting rapidly bigger. I could already see it was painted on an elongated, whale-shaped hull, glistening silver, with the needles of radio antenna protruding from its sides and rows of darker window openings. This metal colossus wasn't resting on the surface of the planet, but was suspended above it, its shadow moving across an inky background in the form of an elliptical patch of even more intense blackness. Simultaneously, I noticed the violet-flushed furrows of the ocean, which betrayed a faint motion. The clouds suddenly rose high up, their edges marked with dazzling crimson. The sky between them grew distant and flat, dull orange in color, and everything became blurred. I'd entered spin. Before I could utter a word, a brief impact returned the capsule to a horizontal position, and the ocean, glittering with a mercuric light to the very limits of the horizon, appeared in the spy hole. The droning cords and rings of the parachute suddenly detached and flew off over the waves, carried by the wind. The capsule rocked softly with that particular slowed-down motion characteristic of an artificial force field, and moved downward. The last thing I was able to see were latticework flight catapults and the grids of two radio telescope dishes that looked to be several stories high. Something immobilized the capsule with a terrifying noise of steel striking firmly against steel. Something opened up beneath me, and the metal shell in which I had been rigidly encased ended its 110-mile journey with a prolonged, wheezing sigh.
Solaris Station, 0 and 0. Docking complete. Over and out.
Came the lifeless voice of the control mechanism. With both hands, I could sense a vague pressure on my chest, and my innards felt like an irksome burden. I took hold of the grips directly opposite my shoulders and disconnected the cables. A green sign reading Earth came on, and the side of the capsule opened. The pneumatic berth pushed me gently in the back, so that in order not to stumble, I had to take a step forward. With a soft hiss, like a resigned sigh, the air left the coils of the spacesuit. I was free. I stood beneath a silver funnel, high as a nave. Bundles of colored pipes led down the walls, disappearing into circular wells. I turned around. The ventilation shafts were roaring, drawing in what was left of the poisonous atmosphere of the planet that had gotten in during the docking. The cigar of the capsule, empty as a burst cocoon, stood in a concavity set into a steel platform. Its external plating had been scorched to a dirty brown color. I walked down the short ramp. Beyond it, a layer of rough plastic had been welded to the metal deck. It had worn away in places from the wheels of the mobile rocket jacks. The air conditioning compressor suddenly went off, and there was complete silence. I looked around somewhat helplessly. I'd expected someone to appear, but nobody had come. There was nothing but a glowing neon arrow indicating a soundless, moving walkway. I stepped onto it. The ceiling of the hangar curved down in an elegant parabola that became the tube of a corridor. In its alcoves, there were heaps of pressurized gas cylinders, containers, annular parachutes, crates, all in disorderly piles, any old how. That made me think, too. The walkway ended at a point where the corridor widened into a circular space. Here, there was an even bigger jumble. Under a mound of metal canisters, an oily fluid had leaked and formed a puddle. A strong, unpleasant odor filled the air. Boot prints marked clearly in the sticky substance led in different directions. Among the cans lay rolls of white telegraph tape, torn papers, and trash, all of which looked as if it had been swept out of the cabins. And there was another illuminated sign directing me to the middle door. It led to a corridor so narrow that two people could barely have passed one another. Light came from high-placed windows with biconvex panes directed at the sky. There was another door, painted with a green and white checkerboard. It was ajar. I entered. The semi-spherical cabin had one large panoramic window, in which the mist-covered sky was aglow. Down below, the blackish hills of the waves moved soundlessly. There were numerous open cabinets around the walls. They were filled with technical instruments, books, glasses with a dried residue at the bottom, dust-covered thermos flasks. Around the dirty floor, there were five or six mechanical tables on wheels, and among them several armchairs that were deflated and sagging. Only one was blown up, its backrest leaning to the rear. In it sat a small, scrawny man with a sunburned face. The skin was peeling from his nose and cheekbones. I knew who he was. It was Snout, Gabarian's second in command, a cybernetician. In his time, he'd published a number of highly original articles in the Journal of Solaristics. I'd never met him in person before. He was wearing a mesh shirt, tufts of gray hair on his flat chest poking through, and once white linen pants with multiple pockets like a mechanic's, stained at the knees and burned from reagents. He was holding a plastic bulb of the kind used to drink out of on ships that lack artificial gravity. He looked at me as if he'd been dazzled by a blinding light. The bulb fell from his fingers as they unclenched and bounced a couple of times on the floor like a ball. A splash of clear liquid spilled from it. The blood drained slowly from his face. I was too taken aback to say anything, and this wordless scene continued until in some mysterious way his fear was transferred to me. I took a step forward. He shrank into his armchair. "Snout?" I whispered. He winced as if he'd been struck. Staring at me with inexpressible aversion, he said hoarsely,
I don't know you. I don't know you. What do you want?
The spilled liquid evaporated quickly. I caught the smell of alcohol. Was he drinking? Drunk? Well, why was he so afraid? I was still standing in the middle of the cabin. My knees were wobbly, and my ears felt like they'd been stopped up with cotton wool. The pressure of the floor beneath my feet still didn't seem entirely reliable. Outside the convex window, the ocean was moving evenly. Snout kept his bloodshot eyes on me. The fear was leaving his face, but the unutterable disgust remained. "What's wrong with you?" I asked in a murmur. "Are you sick?"
"You're concerned," he said in a hollow voice. "So you're going to be concerned? Well, why about me? I don't know you."
"Where's Gabarian?" I asked. For a moment he held his breath. His eyes glassed over. Something lit up in them and went out again.
No. No!
He shook with soundless, idiotic laughter, then abruptly fell silent.
"You've come to see Gabarian," he said almost calmly. "Gabarian! What do you mean to do with him?"
He was looking at me as if all at once I'd ceased to be a threat to him. In his words, and even more in their tone, there was something hateful and offensive.
"What are you talking about?" I stammered, feeling dazed. "Where is he?"
He was stunned.
"You don't know?"
"He's drunk," I thought to myself. "Drunk to the point of unconsciousness." I was growing increasingly angry. I really ought to have left, but I ran out of patience.
"Get a grip on yourself," I roared. "How am I supposed to know when I just flew in a moment ago? What's the matter with you, snout?"
His jaw dropped. Once again he held his breath for a second, but in a different way, and a sudden glint appeared in his eye. He gripped the armrest of the chair with trembling hands and stood up with difficulty, his joints cracking.
"What?"
he said, almost soberly.
"You flew in?"
"From where?"
"From Earth,"
I replied, furious. "Maybe you heard of it, though it doesn't look that way."
"From Earth? Good grief. So you're Kelvin?"
"That's right. Why are you looking at me that way? What's strange about that?"
"Nothing,"
he said, blinking rapidly.
"Nothing."
He wiped his forehead.
"Kelvin, I'm sorry. It's nothing, you know. Just the surprise. I wasn't expecting you."
"What do you mean you weren't expecting me? You were informed months ago, and Moddard telegraphed today from the Prometheus."
"Right, right. No doubt. It's just that here, as you can see, there's a certain amount of confusion."
"No kidding," I retorted dryly. "It's hard not to notice." Snout walked around me as if he wanted to check out the look of my spacesuit, which was the most ordinary kind, with its harness of pipes and cables on the chest. He gave a series of coughs. He rubbed his bony nose.
"Maybe you'd like to take a shower? It'd do you good. It's the blue door across the way."
"Thanks, I know the layout of the station."
"Are you hungry, maybe?"
"No." "Where's Gabarian?" He went up to the window as if he hadn't heard my question. With his back turned, he looked much older. His close-cut hair was gray. The back of his neck, burned by the sun, was crisscrossed with wrinkles deep as cuts. Outside the window, the crests of the waves glistened, rising and falling so slowly it seemed as if the ocean was congealing. Looking down there, I had the impression the station was moving imperceptibly sideways, as if it were slipping off an invisible base. Then it returned to equilibrium and tipped lazily in the other direction. But it was probably an illusion. Stretches of slimy foam, the color of bone, were gathering in the troughs between the waves. For a split second, I felt a twinge of nausea in the pit of my stomach. The cold orderliness of the Prometheus now seemed to me something precious and irrevocably lost.
"Listen," Snout said unexpectedly. "For the moment, it's just me."
He turned around and rubbed his hands nervously.
"You'll have to be content with my company, for now. Call me Rat. You only know me from photographs, but it doesn't matter. Everyone uses that name. Nothing to be done about it, I'm afraid. Besides, when you have parents with such cosmic aspirations as mine, even Rat starts to sound okay."
"Where's Gabarian?" I asked again insistently. He blinked.
"I'm sorry I greeted you like that. It's not entirely my fault. I completely forgotten. There's been a lot going on here, you know."
"All right," I replied. "Never mind that. So, what's with Gabarian? Is he not on the station? Did he fly somewhere?"
"No,"
came the answer. He looked into the corner of the cabin, which was hidden behind a pile of coiled cables.
"He didn't fly anywhere. And he's not going to. Precisely because of that. Among other things."
"What?" I asked. My ears were still blocked, and I had the feeling I wasn't hearing right. "What's that supposed to mean? Where is he?"
"Come on, you know,"
he said in a completely different tone of voice. He looked me in the eye so coldly it gave me goose flesh. He may have been drunk, but he knew what he was saying. "Surely he's not..."
"Yes."
"An accident?" He nodded. He wasn't just confirming, he was also sanctioning my reaction. "When?"
today, at dawn.
Strange to relate, I didn't feel shock. This entire short exchange of monosyllabic question and answer rather calmed me by its matter-of-factness. I felt I now understood his previously unaccountable behavior.
How? Go get changed, settle in, and come back here in, let's say, an hour.
I hesitated a moment.
Fine. Wait,
he said as I was turning to the door. He gave me a peculiar look. I could see that what he wanted to say stuck in his throat.
There were three of us, and now, with you, there are three again. Do you know Sartorius?
Like I know you, from pictures.
He's in the lab upstairs. I doubt he'll come out before nightfall, but in any case, you'll recognize him. If you should see anyone else, you understand, not me or Sartorius, you understand, and...
Then what?
I wasn't sure if I was dreaming. Against the background of the black waves glinting bloodily in the low sun, he sat back in the armchair, his head drooping as before, and stared to the side at the reels of cable.
Then... don't do anything.
Who might I see? A ghost? I exclaimed.
I get it. You think I've gone crazy? No, I haven't gone crazy. I don't know any other way to tell you for the moment. Besides, maybe nothing will happen. In any case, remember, you've been warned.
About what? What are you on about?
Stay calm, he persisted. Act as if... be prepared for anything. That's impossible, I know, but try anyhow. It's the only way. I don't know any other. But what am I going to see?
I almost shouted. I barely kept myself from grabbing him by the shoulders and giving him a good shake as he sat there, staring into the corner with his tired, sunburned face, every word he uttered costing a visible effort.
I don't know. In a certain sense, it depends on you.
Hallucinations?
No. It's real.
Don't attack. Remember.
What are you talking about?
I said in a voice not my own.
We're not on Earth.
Polytheria? But they don't look anything like humans, I burst out. I didn't know what to do to make him snap out of his trance, in which he seemed to be reading something so senseless it chilled the blood in his veins.
That's exactly why it's so terrible, he said quietly. Remember...
be on your guard.
What happened to Gabarian? He didn't answer. What's Sartorius doing?
Come back in an hour.
I turned and left. As I opened the door, I looked at him one more time. He sat with his face in his hands, small, shrunken, in stained pants. It was only now that I noticed he had dried blood on the knuckles of both hands. Chapter 2. Solaricists. The tubular corridor was empty. I stood for a moment at the closed door, listening. The walls must have been thin. From outside there came the whining of the wind. On the door there was a crooked rectangle of first aid plaster that had been stuck up carelessly, bearing the inscription, Human. I stared at the scrawled, barely legible word. For a moment I thought about going back to Snout, but I realized that wasn't possible. His demented warning still rang in my ears. I moved off, and my shoulders were bowed by the bothersome weight of this spacesuit. Quietly, as if hiding from an unseen observer, I returned to the circular hall with the five doors. They bore nameplates. Dr. Gabarian, Dr. Snout, Dr. Sartorius. On the fourth, there was no name. I hesitated, then pressed down lightly on the handle and slowly pushed. As it opened, I had the feeling, bordering on certainty, that someone was there. I went inside. There was no one. An identical convex window, though slightly smaller, looked out onto the ocean, which from here, against the sun, shone greasily, as if reddened olive oil were dripping from the crests of the waves. The crimson glow filled the entire room, which was like a spaceship cabin. On one side, there were shelves with books and other items, a bunk strapped to the wall and secured with universal joints. On the other were numerous cabinets, between which were aerial photographs stuck together in nickel-plated frames. In metal holders, there were flasks and test tubes stopped with cotton wool. By the window were two rows of white enamel cases so close together there was hardly room to squeeze through. The lids of some of them were half open. They were full of different kinds of tools and plastic hoses. In both corners, there were faucets, a smoke extractor, freezers. A microscope stood on the floor, since there was no longer any room for it on the large table next to the window. When I turned around, right by the door, I saw an open locker as high as the ceiling, filled with overalls, workwear, and protective aprons. There was underwear on the shelves, and among the anti-radiation boots was the glint of aluminum flasks for use with portable oxygen packs. Two packs, complete with masks, hung from the rail of the raised bed. Everywhere there was the same disarray, which had been only hurriedly and superficially tidied. I sniffed the air testingly and smelled a faint aroma of chemical reagents and the trace of a sharp odor. Could it possibly have been chlorine? Instinctively, my eyes sought the ventilation grates in the upper corners of the room. The slips of paper fastened to their frames were flapping gently to show the compressors were working, maintaining normal air circulation. I moved the books, apparatus, and tools from two chairs, stuffing them into the corners as best I could, till some space was more or less cleared around the bed between the locker and the shelves. I pulled up a stand to hang my spacesuit on. I took hold of the zippers, but let go immediately. I couldn't bring myself to take off the suit, as if it would leave me defenseless. Once again, I took in the whole room. I checked the door was properly closed, and since there was no lock, after a moment's hesitation, I pushed the two heaviest crates against it. Once this makeshift barricade was in place, with a couple of tugs, I freed myself of the heavy, creaking garment. A narrow mirror inside the locker reflected part of the room. Out of the corner of my eye, I caught sight of a movement there. I started, but it turned out to be my own reflection. The shirt I had on under my spacesuit was drenched in sweat. I yanked it off and pushed the locker sideways. It slid aside. In an alcove behind it were the gleaming walls of a tiny bathroom. On the ground, under the shower, was a large flat case. Not without difficulty, I hauled it into the main room. When I laid it on the floor, the lid popped open as if on a spring, and I saw compartments filled with bizarre exhibits, a host of implements similar to those in the cabinets, but in approximate or distorted versions in dark metal. None of them were of any use. They were misshapen, blunted, half-melted, as if they'd been in a fire. The strangest thing was that the handles, which were made of ceramite and so virtually unmeltable, were damaged in the same way. No laboratory oven would have been capable of reaching the temperatures necessary to produce this effect, unless it was inside an atomic pile. From the pocket of my spacesuit, I took out a small Geiger counter, but when I held it up to the mangled tools, its black beak remained silent. I was wearing only underwear and a loose-weave T-shirt. I tossed both on the floor, like rags, and naked, jumped in the shower. The sudden rush of water felt like relief. I twisted beneath the hard, hot stream of water, massaging my body, snorting, all in a somehow exaggerated way, as if I was shaking off, expelling from myself the whole obscure uncertainty that filled the station with its infectious suspicions. From the locker, I dug out a light tracksuit that also could be worn under a spacesuit, and transferred all my modest belongings to its pockets. Between the pages of my notebook, I felt something hard. It was the key to my apartment on Earth. Goodness knows how it had gotten there. I turned it in my fingers a moment, not knowing what to do with it. In the end, I laid it on the table. It occurred to me I might need a weapon. My all-purpose pocket knife certainly wouldn't do the trick, but I didn't have anything else, and I wasn't yet in the kind of mental state that would make me go looking for a ray gun or anything of that kind. I sat in a metal chair in the middle of the open space, far from all objects. I wanted to be alone. I was glad to see I still had half an hour. I couldn't help it. Exactitude in carrying out any commitment, however important or trivial, was always in my nature. The hands of the 24-hour clock stood at 7 a.m. The sun was setting. 7 local time was 2000 hours on the Prometheus. Solaris would be shrinking to the size of a dot on Moddard's screen. It would be indistinguishable from the stars. But what could the Prometheus matter to me? I closed my eyes. There was total silence, aside from the whine of the pipes at regular intervals. Water ticked softly in the bathroom as it dripped into the porcelain basin. Gabarian was dead, if I'd understood Snout correctly. Less than a day had passed since his death. What had they done with the body? Had they buried it? Oh, right, on this planet that couldn't be done. I thought about it in a matter-of-fact way for a long while, as if what had become of the dead man was the most essential thing here, until, realizing how ridiculous these thoughts were, I stood up and began pacing diagonally across the room. With the tip of my foot, I kicked at the books scattered about at a small empty field satchel. I bent down and picked it up. It turned out not to be empty after all. It contained a dark glass bottle that weighed so little it felt like it was made of paper. I held it up to the window, where the last dismal red light of the sunset was blurred by a dirty mist. What was wrong with me? Why was I occupying myself with any old nonsense, with whatever insignificant trifle fell to my hand? I gave a start. The light had come on. Of course, the photocell triggered by the falling dusk. I was filled with anticipation. The tension had grown to the point where I didn't want to have open space behind me. I decided to fight it. I moved the chair up to the shelves. I took down a book I knew only too well, the second volume of Hughes and Ugel's old History of Solaris, and started flipping through it, resting the thick, stiff spine on my lap. Solaris had been discovered almost 100 years before I was born. The planet orbits 2 suns, a red one and a blue one. For over 40 years, no spaceship came near to it. In those days, the Gamma of Shapley hypothesis concerning the impossibility of life arising on planets around double stars went unquestioned. The orbits of such planets are constantly changing from the gravitational interplay of 2 suns circling around one another. The resulting perturbations successively reduce and expand the planet's orbit, and the beginnings of life, if they emerge, are destroyed by radiant heat or freezing cold. These changes occur over a period of millions of years, which is to say, on an astronomical or biological scale, for evolution requires hundreds of millions, if not billions of years, a very short time. According to initial calculations, in the course of 500,000 years, Solaris was supposed to move to within half an astronomical unit of its red sun, then, after another million years, fall into its burning maw. But only 10 or 20 years later, it became apparent that the planet's orbit was not showing the expected changes, exactly as if it were as regular as the courses of planets in our own solar system. The observations and calculations were now repeated, this time with the utmost exactness, and they revealed only what was already known, that Solaris possessed an unstable orbit. From one of several hundred planets discovered yearly and added into the great databases with a few notes concerning the fundamentals of their motion, Solaris advanced to the rank of a body worthy of special attention. As a consequence, 4 years after this discovery, it was orbited by the Ottenskjold expedition, which studied it from the Laocoon and 2 accompanying auxiliary ships. This expedition constituted a makeshift improvised reconnaissance, the more so because it lacked the capability to make a landing. It launched into equatorial and polar orbit a number of unmanned observer satellites, whose main task was to take measurements of gravitational potentials. Furthermore, it investigated the surface of the planet, which was almost in its entirety covered by ocean and the few plateaus rising above it. Their combined area was less than that of Europe, though Solaris was 20% larger than Earth in diameter. Those scraps of rocky, desert-like land, scattered irregularly across the planet, were mostly found in the southern hemisphere. Studies were also conducted on the atmosphere, which contained no oxygen, and highly detailed measurements were taken of the density of the planet, as well as its albedo and other astronomical indicators. As expected, no life forms were found, either on the land or in the ocean. Over the following 10 years, Solaris, now the center of attention of all observatories in the area, demonstrated a remarkable tendency to maintain what was beyond any doubt a gravitationally unstable orbit. For a while there was a hint of scandal in the matter, since, in the interests of science, attempts were made to blame the results of these observations either on certain people or on the instruments they employed. A shortage of funding delayed the dispatch of a proper expedition to Solaris for 3 more years, until the moment when Shanahan, having assembled a crew, managed to secure 3 sea-tonnage Cosmodrome-class vessels from the Institute. 1.5 years before the arrival of the expedition, which set off from the Alpha Aquarii region, a second exploratory fleet put an unmanned satellite, Luna 247, in solar orbit on behalf of the Institute. The satellite, rebuilt 3 times over the space of several decades, has continued to work to this day. The data it collected definitively confirmed what the Ottenskjold expedition had observed concerning the active nature of the ocean's movements. One of Shanahan's ships remained at a high orbit, while the other 2 made the necessary preparations and landed on a rocky stretch of ground that occupied about 600 square miles at Solaris's south pole. The expedition wrapped up its work after 18 months. It went well, except for 1 accident caused by an equipment malfunction. The crew, however, divided into 2 mutually opposing camps. The object of their disagreement was the ocean. On the basis of their analyses, it had been designated an organic formation. At the time, no one dared say it was alive. Yet while the biologists saw it as a primitive being, something like an immense syncytium, in other words, a single monstrously grown fluid cell, even though they called it a prebiological form, that extended across the entire globe in a jelly-like covering whose depth reached several miles in places. The astronomers and physicists, on the other hand, claimed it must be a highly organized structure, perhaps exceeding terrestrial organisms in its complexity, since it was capable of actively influencing the orbit of its plane, for no other cause had been discovered that might explain Solaris's behavior. In addition, planetary physicists had uncovered a relationship between certain processes in the plasmic ocean and local measurements of gravitational potential, which changed depending on the ocean's metabolic rate. In this way, it was physicists, not biologists, who proposed the paradoxical formulation plasmic machine to refer to a formation that in our sense might be devoid of life, but was capable of undertaking purposive actions on a scale that, let us add at once, was astronomical. In this dispute, which in the space of weeks sucked in every leading authority like a whirlwind, the Gamow-Shapley hypothesis was brought into question for the first time in 80 years. For a period, efforts were made to defend it by asserting that the ocean had nothing to do with life, that it wasn't even a parabiological or prebiological formation, but a geological entity, no doubt of an unusual kind, but whose only capability was to preserve Solaris's orbit through changes in gravitational pull. Reference was made to Le Chatelier's principle. To counter this conservatism, there arose suggestions, such as the Civita-Vitti hypothesis, one of the better constructed, claiming that the ocean was the product of a dialectical development, starting from its original form, that of a proto-ocean, a solution of sluggishly interacting chemical substances, under the pressure of conditions, meaning the orbital changes that threatened its existence, without passing through all the terrestrial stages of development. That is to say, the emergence of protozoa and metazoa, plant and animal evolution. Without developing a nervous system, it had been able to jump directly to the phase of a homeostatic ocean. Put simply, unlike terrestrial organisms, it did not adapt to its surroundings over the course of hundreds of millions of years, so as only then to produce a rational species, but it had gained control over its environment from the start. This was highly original, except that it was still the case no one knew how a syrupy jelly could stabilize the orbit of a celestial body. For almost a century, there had existed devices that created artificial force fields and gravitational fields, gravitors, but no one could even imagine how the effects a gravitor achieves through a complex series of nuclear reactions and extremely high temperatures could be accomplished by an amorphous ooze. In the newspapers, which in those days, to the delight of their readers and the despair of scientists, reveled in the most indiscriminate conjectures concerning the enigma of Solaris, there were claims that the planetary ocean was a distant relative of Earth's electric eel. When the problem was at least in some measure cleared up, it transpired that, as was so often the case with Solaris, one mystery had been replaced with another that was perhaps even more puzzling. Research revealed that the ocean did not operate at all like our gravitors, which of course would have been impossible, but that it was capable of directly modeling space-time specifications, which led, among other things, to variations in the measurement of time at one and the same meridian on Solaris. In this way, the ocean not only in a certain sense knew the Einstein-Bove hypothesis, but, unlike us humans, was even able to make use of its consequences. When this emerged, one of the most tempestuous storms of our century broke out in the scientific world. Some of the most venerable theories, universally regarded as correct, collapsed in ruins. The most heretical articles began to appear in the scientific literature, and the brilliant ocean versus gravitational jelly debate set every mind on fire. All this happened a good 15 or so years before I was born. When I was at school, thanks to facts discovered later, Solaris was widely regarded as a planet endowed with life, but with only a single inhabitant. The second volume of Hughes and Ugel, which I was still abstractedly thumbing through, opened with a taxonomy that was as original as it was amusing. A classification table showed the following. Type: Polytheria. Order: Syncytialia. Class: Metamorpha. It was as if we knew goodness knows how many specimens, whereas in reality there was still only one, which, admittedly, weighed 17 billion tons. I flipped past colored diagrams and graphs, analyses and spectrographs, setting out the class and tempo of basic metabolism and its chemical reactions. The deeper I immersed myself in the bulky tome, the more mathematics appeared on its chalk-white pages. It might have seemed that our knowledge of this representative of the class of Metamorpha, which lay swathed in the darkness of its four-hour night, 1,000 or so feet below the steel bed of the station, was complete. In reality, however, not everyone agreed that this was a being, quite aside from the question of whether an ocean could be called rational. I plunked the big book back on the shelf and took down the next volume. It was divided into two parts. The first constituted a summary of the results of all the innumerable experiments aimed at making contact with the ocean. As I remember only too well, this contact was the source of endless anecdotes, witticisms, and jokes when I was in school. Medieval scholastics seemed a model of clarity compared with the jungle that this matter gave rise to. The second part of the volume, comprising almost 1,300 pages, contained nothing but a bibliography. There would not have been space in the room I was in for all the original literature on the topic. The first attempts at contact employed special electronic devices that transformed stimuli sent in both directions. The ocean played an active part in the design of the devices, though all this happened in complete darkness. What does it mean to say it played an active part? It modified certain components of the equipment lowered into it, as a result of which the discharges it registered would change, and the devices would record a multitude of signals that were like fragments of some vast, advanced analysis. But what did it all mean? Perhaps these data captured a temporary state of excitation of the ocean. Perhaps they were impulses that gave rise to its immense creations somewhere thousands of miles from the researchers. Perhaps they were expressions of the ocean's eternal truths, converted into inscrutable electronic formulations. Perhaps they were works of art. Who could know, since it was never possible to produce the same reaction to a stimulus twice? Since one time the response would be an explosion of impulses that almost blew the apparatus up, the next time, profound silence. since no experiment could ever be replicated. It always seemed as if we were just on the brink of deciphering this constantly accumulating sea of readings. It was for this purpose that electronic brains were constructed, with the ability to process more information than had ever been required by any problem before now. And in fact, certain results were obtained. The ocean, a source of electrical, magnetic, and gravitational impulses, spoke, as it were, in the language of mathematics. Certain sequences of its electrical discharges could be classified by drawing on the most abstract branches of terrestrial analysis and of set theory. They contained homologues of structures known from the area of physics that is concerned with the mutual relationship between energy and matter, finite and infinite magnitude, particles and fields. All this led scientists to believe they were dealing with a thinking monster, that it was some kind of protoplasmic sea-cum-brain grown so vast it covered an entire planet, which passed time engrossed in theoretical reflections on an inconceivable scale concerning the nature of the universe, and that what the instruments captured were no more than tiny accidentally overheard snippets of a stupendous monologue utterly beyond our comprehension that was endlessly being performed in its depths. So much for the mathematicians. These hypotheses were regarded by some as an underestimation of human capability, as an obeisance towards something we didn't yet comprehend, which could be understood as a resurrection of the old doctrine of ignoramus et ignorabimus, we do not know and will not know. Others saw these as harmful, sterile fairy stories, and claimed the mathematicians' hypotheses revealed a latter-day mythology that saw an immense brain, whether electronic or plasmic, as the highest goal of being, the sum total of existence. While others yet, but scientists and opinions were legion. Besides, all the attempts at establishing contact were nothing compared to other branches of solaristics, in which specializations grew so advanced a cybernetician was barely able to communicate with a symmetriodologist. Voibeke, who at the time during my studies was director of the institute, once jokingly asked, "How can you communicate with the ocean if you can't communicate with each other?" His jibe contained much truth. For it wasn't by accident that the ocean had been classed as a metamorpha. Its undulating surface was capable of giving rise to the most diverse formations that bore no resemblance to anything terrestrial, on top of which the purpose, adaptive, cognitive, or whatever, of those often violent eruptions of plasmic creativity remained a total mystery. Returning the volume to the shelf, it was so heavy I had to lift it with both hands, I thought to myself that what we know about Solaris, all the knowledge that filled this library, was useless ballast, a mere quagmire of facts, and that we were in the same position as when we'd started to gather this information 78 years ago. In fact, the situation was a lot worse, since all the labors of those years had proved to be in vain. That which we knew in detail contained nothing but contradictions. The ocean did not employ machines or construct them, though in certain circumstances it seemed capable of doing so, since it copied components of some of the devices lowered into it. But it did so only in the first 2 years of the exploratory research. After that, with boundless patience, it ignored repeated attempts, as if it had lost all interest in our instruments and artifacts, and thus, it seemed, in us. To continue with our negative knowledge, it did not possess a nervous system, or cells, or any structure resembling protein. It didn't always respond to stimuli, even the most powerful. For instance, it completely ignored the disaster involving the auxiliary rocket ship of Giza's second expedition, which plummeted from a height of 200 miles to the surface of the planet, destroying plasma for a mile and a half around when its atomic piles exploded. In scientific circles, the case of Solaris gradually began to sound like a lost cause, especially among the academic leadership of the Institute, where in recent years voices had been raised calling for cuts in future research funding. No one yet dared suggest closing down the station completely. This would be too overt an admission of failure, though some, at least privately, said that all we needed was a strategy for as honorable a retreat as possible from the Solaris affair. But for many, especially young people, this affair eventually became something of a touchstone of one's own worth. In essence, they would say, the stakes are higher than exploring the civilization of Solaris. This is about us ourselves, about the limits of human cognition. For some time, one popular view, eagerly disseminated by the press, was that the thinking ocean covering the whole of Solaris was a gigantic brain, more advanced by millions of years than our own civilization. That it was some kind of cosmic yogi, a sage, omniscience incarnate, which had long ago grasped the futility of all action, and for this reason was maintaining a categorical silence towards us. This was simply untrue, because the living ocean certainly does act. It's just that it does so according to notions other than those of humans. It doesn't build cities or bridges, or flying machines. It doesn't try to conquer space or cross it, something defenders of human superiority insisted on seeing as an invaluable trump card for us. Instead, it occupies itself with thousandfold transformations, ontological autometamorphosis. There was no lack of learned terminology in the literature on Solaris. Since, on the other hand, anyone plunging stubbornly into all this literature cannot resist the impression that though he encounters fragments of perhaps brilliant intellectual constructions, these fragments are mixed indiscriminately with the products of utter foolishness bordering on insanity. As an antithesis to the concept of the oceanic yogi, there arose the idea of the oceanic idiot. These hypotheses resuscitated one of the most ancient of philosophical problems, the relationship between matter and consciousness. It took a fair amount of courage to lead the way, like Duhart, in attributing consciousness to the ocean. This problem, which the methodologists overly hastily classified as metaphysical, smoldered beneath virtually every discussion and dispute. Was thinking without consciousness possible? Yet could the processes that took place in the ocean be regarded as thought? Is a mountain a very large rock? Is a planet a huge mountain? These terms can be used, but the new scale of magnitude brings with it new regularities and new phenomena. This problem became a squaring of the circle for our times. Every independent thinker strove to make his own contribution to the treasury of solaristics. Theories multiplied. They claimed we were dealing with the result of a degeneration or regression that had set in after the period of the ocean's intellectual splendor, or that the ocean was in fact a neoplasmic glioma, which having come into existence within the bodies of former inhabitants of the planet, had consumed them all and swallowed them up, fusing the remains together in the form of an everlasting, self-rejuvenating, supracellular element. In the white glow of neon lamps that was reminiscent of terrestrial light, I removed the instruments and books from the table, and spreading a map of Solaris on the plastic surface, I leaned over it, my hands resting on the metal trim. The living ocean had its shallows and its trenches, while its islands were coated with a deposit of weathered minerals that showed they had once constituted its bottom. Did it also regulate the rise and fall of the rock formations immersed in its utterly dark bosom? I gazed at the massive hemispheres on the map, colored in various shades of purple and pale blue. I felt, as countless times before in my life, a sense of wonder just as thrilling as the first time, when as a boy I had learned at school about the existence of Solaris. I don't know how it came about that my surroundings, including the lurking mystery of Gabarian's death, even my own unknown future, all suddenly seemed unimportant. And I thought about nothing whatsoever as I pored over the map, which any human would have found overwhelming. The various areas of the living formation were named after scientists who had dedicated their lives to exploring them. I was studying the Thexol glia massif that flowed around the equatorial islands when I felt someone's eyes on me. I was still standing over the map, but I no longer saw it. It was as if I were paralyzed. The door was straight in front of me. It was barricaded with crates. Plus, I'd pushed a locker against them. Must have been an automat, I thought to myself, though there hadn't been any in the room before, and none could have come in without my noticing. The skin on my back and the nape of my neck began to tingle. The feeling of a hard, motionless gaze was becoming unbearable.
I didn't realize that as I shrank my head into my shoulders, I was leaning more and more heavily on the table. In the end, it began to move slowly across the floor, and it was this movement that seemed to free me. I turned around abruptly. The room was empty. In front of me, there was only the gaping black of the bay window. The sensation lingered. The darkness was looking at me, amorphous, immense, eyeless, devoid of limits. The gloom outside was unbrightened by even a single star. I drew the lightproof drapes. I'd not even been a whole hour at the station, and I was already starting to understand why incidents of paranoia had occurred here. I connected it instinctively with Gabarian's death. Knowing him, I thought till now that nothing could have disturbed his mind. I was no longer so sure. I stood in the middle of the room next to the table. My breathing grew calmer. I could feel the sweat that had broken out on my forehead cooling. What had I been thinking about a moment ago? Oh, that's right, automats. The fact that I'd not seen a single one in the corridor or in the cabins was very strange. Where are they all gone? The only one I'd encountered, at a distance, had belonged to the mechanized service at the docking bay. What about the others? I glanced at my watch. It was just about time to go and see Snout. I left the cabin. The corridor was rather dimly lit by fluorescent lighting strips mounted on the ceiling. I passed two doors and came to the one that bore Gabarian's name. For a long time, I stood in front of it. The station was filled with silence. I took hold of the door handle. The truth was, I really didn't want to go in. The handle moved downwards. The door cracked open an inch or so. There was a gap that for a moment was black. Then the light came on. Now I could be seen by anyone walking along the corridor. I quickly crossed the threshold and closed the door behind me quietly and firmly. Then I turned around. I stood with my back almost touching the door. The cabin was bigger than mine. It also had a panoramic window, which was 3/4 covered by a net curtain decorated with small blue and pink flowers that was clearly not a station fitting, but had been brought from Earth. The walls were lined with bookshelves and cabinets, both painted with a very pale green enamel that had a silvery sheen. Their contents had been tipped onto the floor in piles and lay heaped among the upright chairs and armchairs. Right in front of me, the way was barred by two tables on wheels that were tipped over and partially buried in mounds of journals that were spilling from damaged binders. Books with pages flapping open were drenched in fluids from broken flasks and bottles with fitted corks that mostly were made of such thick glass that simply being dropped on the floor, even from a considerable height, would not have been enough to smash them. By the window was an overturned desk with a broken adjustable lamp. A stool lay in front of it, two of its legs thrust among the half-open drawers. There was a veritable flood of papers, handwritten sheets, and other documents spilling across the entire floor. I recognized Gabarian's handwriting and bent down. As I picked up loose sheets of notepaper, I noticed that my arm was casting not one shadow as it had till now, but two. I turned around. As if it had been set alight from the top, the pink curtain was burning with a vivid line of fierce blue fire that was widening with every moment. I tugged the fabric aside, and my eyes were struck by a terrifying blaze. It occupied a third of the horizon. A tangle of weirdly elongated shadows ran across the indentations of the waves toward the station. It was the dawn. In the zone where the station was located, after an hour-long night, the planet's second blue sun rose into the sky. The automatic switch turned off the ceiling lights as I went back to the scattered papers. I found a concise outline of an experiment that had been prepared 3 weeks before. Gabarian had planned to subject the plasma to extremely hard X radiation. From the text I gathered, the description was meant for Sartorius, who was to set up the experiment. What I had in my hand was a copy. The white sheets of paper were starting to dazzle me. The day that was beginning was different from the preceding one. Beneath the orange sky of the cooling sun, the ocean, ink-black with bloody flecks, was almost always covered with a dirty pink mist that fused sky, clouds, and waves together.
Now all this had disappeared. Even filtered by the pink fabric, the light glowed like the burner of a powerful halogen lamp. It made the suntan on my arms look almost gray. The whole room was transformed. Everything that had been red turned brown and faded to the color of liver, whereas the color of white, green, and yellow objects was so intensified they looked as if they were emitting their own glow. I squinted through the crack in the curtains. The sky was a white sea of fire, beneath which what looked like molten metal was twitching and trembling. I squeezed my eyes shut at the red circles that were filling my field of vision. On the shelf of the wash basin, the edge of which was cracked, I found a pair of sunglasses and put them on. They covered almost half of my face. The curtain covering the window was now flaring like a sodium flame. I went on reading, picking up sheets of paper from the floor and stacking them on the one small table still standing. Parts of the text were missing. These were reports of experiments already conducted. From them I learned that the ocean had been subjected to radiation for 4 days, at a point located 1,400 miles northeast of the station. All this shocked me, since the use of X-rays had been banned by a UN convention because of their lethal effect, and I was quite sure no one had sought permission on Earth for these studies. At a certain moment I raised my head, and in the mirror of an open locker I caught sight of my own reflection, a deathly pale face and dark glasses. The room looked extraordinary, burning white and light blue. But a few minutes later there was an extended grinding noise, and hermetic blinds came down outside the windows. The room darkened. Then the artificial lighting came back on, now strangely wan. The place heated up, till at one point the steady hum from the air conditioning conduits turned into a strained whine. The cooling system of the station was working at full blast. Despite this, the lifeless heat kept intensifying. I heard footsteps. Someone was coming down the corridor. In a couple of soundless strides, I was at the door. The steps slowed and stopped. Whoever it was standing outside the door. The handle moved slightly. Without thinking, I grabbed it from my side and held on. The pressure didn't increase, but neither did it ease off. The person on the other side was being as silent as me, as if taken aback. For a good while, we both held onto the handle. Then it jumped back up suddenly in my hand. It had been released, and a rustling sound let me know that the other person was walking away. I stood for a moment longer, listening intently. But nothing could be heard.